You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to another edition of Radio MMT with Anne and Kev, except Anne's not here today. I'm here with Katie, who's going to join me on the show today. And this is the first live show I've done in a little while because I've been away, up the coast doing stuff, getting my head away from news and stuff. But hey, Katie, how are you?
Excellent, thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure to be on licensed premises with you.
Excellent. Right. Hey, now, how come I know you, Katie? What's the connection?
Mainly from the MMT pub group, yeah.
Right, yeah, and the pub group's just a group of MMT-interested people, some of whom are students studying a particular brand of economics that is informed by MMT, and other people. I'm not a student. I just roll up because I'm part of the MMT community. So I'd recommend to anybody who's a listener that wants to just roll up and find out a bit more about this stuff, come and join us at the pub, which is usually the fourth Friday of the month. I might go to the pub after the show tonight. I don't know. We'll figure something out. So, Katie, you're here to fill in, but I've got to say, I've been away, and I'm a bit of a news hound. I like always knowing what's going on, and social media a bit, and I've let it all go. I've just let everything go. I just don't worry about what's happening the whole time, and
that could be healthy.
It was. It was kind of like, there's this kind of, if you're not right up to date the whole time, you think, oh, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. And there's this kind of like this need to know or a FOMO of some sort. And I didn't. I disconnected from Facebook. I stopped watching the news. And all that happened was that the stuff that I was supposed to catch up with every day, 3 or 4 times a day, was exactly the same, like, you know, a week later or 2 weeks later. So you got to wonder, what's the point of keeping up to date with stuff? Like,
yeah, well, I developed a very complex system, which is basically whenever I found something I thought I might want to read, I just stick it in a separate browser tab to the point where I end up with a 1,000 browser tabs open.
Yeah.
And many months later, I'd get back to the end of the queue and think, oh, this wasn't important at all.
Yeah, the amount of stuff we take in that's not important is enormous. However, knowing about MMT is important. I think.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because, essential.
Because if the stuff that we're told, and a lot of it comes down to economics, about how we can't afford this and how we need to prioritise that, and we all need to be working hard to meet our economic requirements. If we know more about economics, we understand how essentially we're being exploited, most of us, by a system which just keeps on in the hamster wheel, spinning it over so that we can feed money to people who are already rich. And I think if you understand MMT, you understand. Well, does it help? Does it help to understand the problem? Make it worse?
I think it does. I mean, it turns the problem upside down rather than the business of government being managing their money in response to the economy. The government should be using its tool, its own money as a tool to manage the economy, to meet people's needs.
Well, now we were recently involved in a forum up in Canberra where we've done this before. We've done it in Melbourne, and it's people from our group explaining our brand of economics to people. And hopefully, you know, like in Canberra, the aim was to influence people who are influential, people who make policies and decisions that affect the rest of us. And it was an interesting exercise because, you know, you're starting a movement in a new city. It's fairly well established in Melbourne. We've got the group here. Adelaide is well represented, I think. And presented to a room full of people, mainly older white guys. why is that? Why is that? How do we cut through?
First of all, I mean, the gender balance, yes, that was a bit disappointing, but don't discount the power of grey hair, because these are the people who have a lot of time on their hands, yeah, and also are probably fairly accustomed to writing a strongly worded letter or two.
Yeah, the people in Canberra, I mean, I've got to say this, the people in Canberra are so qualified. Like they're not just a random group of people, they're all experts, and when I say that, I mean they really are.
They did seem to be pretty well informed, and they've been following this for some time.
But MMT does have a problem cutting through. It seems that there's criticisms of MMT, which I kind of like, because if they're criticising it, it means they're aware of it. I think that's part of the process, isn't it? First they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then you win. Is that the old slogan or something like that? So they've stopped ignoring us, which, yes, is good, and they are beginning to criticise us now. What's your experience with some of the critiques of MMT?
If you just Google MMT or modern monetary theory, the majority of the first page of results will be people critiquing it, not people who have been involved in it since the start.
Right.
And the people who are critiquing it, I mean, even professional economists who should, as a matter of ethics, actually look into something that they're critiquing fairly rigorously, they hear, you know, snatches of descriptions of what it is we're about, and critique us based on applying those little words and phrases to their understanding of how the economy works, when really it's their fundamental understanding that needs revision.
I guess MMT confronts the orthodoxy. It shouldn't. So let's, for the uninitiated listener, let's basically try and summarise MMT in 20 words or less, which is going to be quite difficult. But essentially, MMT, modern monetary theory, as it's known, it's just an analysis of the economy. It is how I see it. And through that analysis, we understand that all money is created by the government, and the government spends it into the economy and should be the main influence that controls it, except that what we learn through studying the economy through MMT is that largely governments step back and let the private sector hoard and control the flow of money through the economy. That's my kind of 20-second summary of it from my position. And yet we find when we introduce that concept to economists, they get all huffy. They go, "Oh, no, you're all got your heads up your asses." I kind of do understand what the problem is. If it runs contrary to their own their orthodox understanding of how the economy works, which is, in my opinion, largely misinformed and full of misinformation, which is run by an agenda, then I can understand why people who are invested in it might be confronted by that. But what I don't understand is, like, we're in Canberra and we did speak to some politicians, etc. They're not profiting from it. They're just supporting it. They're kind of captured by it.
Yeah. I think there's also a strong sort of moralistic theme to it. The basic belief driving mainstream versions of economics is that money, markets, the economy just sprang up naturally without the involvement of government. And then many, many centuries or millennia later, government came in as this foreign force to distort the natural balance, where everybody was justly rewarded for their contribution to society and everybody got what they wanted to the limits of the scarce resources that were at hand. This is, well, totally ahistorical. It doesn't fit any of the archaeological evidence. But I mean, they never look at the evidence.
No. How long has that version of the economy been kicking around? We presume that that's the only story. Well, that's the main story that's been told. But I think this current version, this very neoliberal version of the economy, as it's explained, it's only been enforced over the last decades. It rears its ugly head. It's up and down. You have the owners of capital create this story and tell you how they need to run the economy, and it ebbs backwards and forwards. But you know, like I'm only a creature of the post-war period, so I don't really know what it was like in the first half of the century. You know, during the 1900s, but it seems to be this oscillating thing, backwards and forwards the whole time, where capital blows out, then people fight back, and you have revolution, and it's this kind of tug of war between who gets the money. Everybody understands the money is created by the government because it says so on the if you have got paper note, it says made by the government. So we all understand where it comes from, but we end up in this tug of war where the capitalists say, "Oh no, you need to let us run things because we do it best," and government's just an interference, like you were saying. They're like an intruder on the on the economy that they created. And then you learn, well, no, you didn't create the economy. And even if you did, which you didn't, the government is now incredibly important in that. This current story that we've got, it's not consistent over centuries and thousands of years. It's a story which is promoted by a group that benefits from it.
Yeah. I mean, you can trace it back to the early Enlightenment if you want to get all historical about it.
Yeah, let's get historical.
And to John Locke, who fought in the English Civil War on the side of Parliament. So there's this big barney between Parliament and the aristocracy about who should rule, and the currently dominating mythology was that kings ruled by divine right. God made them king. By virtue of the fact that if God didn't want him to be king, he wouldn't be king.
Wouldn't be king, right.
So, so you know, Locke was looking for a counter-argument to that, and he basically looked back to some mythical state of nature where everybody was basically a very well-behaved middle-class gentleman, rather like John Locke, coincidentally.
Right. Okay.
All the sort of day-to-day institutions of life, the market and things like that, that all sprang up as a sort of convenience in order to make society more efficient. That was found to be a very useful idea come the late 19th century, after the second industrial revolution, when this burgeoning capitalist class decided it needed a reason to sideline government in order to conduct their affairs the way that they thought they ought to, not in a way that's answerable to the wider public.
I guess what confuses me is you have all these theories and stories about how the economy runs, etc. But it's not that complicated. We know that government creates the money. And I've run this. Anne would hate me for saying this, but let's say you did have an economy that sprung from private enterprise. It didn't, okay. And I'm talking about barter and that sort of stuff. I know. All you people, don't keep your hair on. You know, it's all good. Even if it did, you need a central authority to then control that. That's always going to be government. It's always going to be regulation.
Yeah.
So even if we play the devil's advocate and accept the origin story, which I'm not, but I'm just doing it for an academic exercise, government always becomes central to the distribution of money. It creates the money. It decides who gets the money. It decides how much people are allowed to keep. It controls all this, or it chooses to let go of that control. Like, that's a conscious decision. That's not a complicated story. That's consistent throughout history. And you try and explain that to people, and they look at you like you're mad.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't understand about the resistance to a simple analysis of how the economy works. And I do understand it from the point of view of vested interests, but that's a small group of people. And I guess what they can do is that once they've got control over money beyond the point of stuff that they need, they then transfer money into power and influence. And I don't know, are we just as a species so kind of sponge-like and simple that we just suck it up and say, right, yeah, well, if that's what you're telling us, we'll accept that because, you know, you said so? Are we that dumb?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, this has been the story for going on half a century now, is if you accept the myth that that money markets and billionaires are naturally occurring phenomena, then you see government as an interloper in that whose presence needs to be minimized because they're distorting the natural order and making it less efficient. It's very magical thinking, and it all rests on the authority of those who have become wealthy by virtue of their own, you know, dynamism and merit.
Dynamism or merit or just luck or manipulation or corruption.
Exactly.
Yeah, put themselves in that position. And I guess, like, if government controls the money and government sets the regulations and government is this powerful organisation when it wants to be, how come it can't change the message? How come it can't inform people? You know, it can inform people about smoking. It can inform people about road safety. It can inform people about why they should fight in a war. Mm. Why can't it inform its citizens about the nature of money and how it's simply a device used by government to facilitate the distribution of resources, and that if somebody's got too much of it, we shouldn't allow people to accumulate so much money to then corrupt the power, except that if they've already done that, then they're not going to unseat themselves, are they? It's kind of like I've just put a circular argument going there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not so much that government has allowed people to accumulate so much wealth, it's that they've designed the system to create billionaires and to create, you know, the desperately poor and homeless and unemployed.
Yeah, which is unnecessary, and it's artificial. It doesn't need to be done, but we keep on falling back into this dumb cycle. You know, it's food for thought. We're going to think, but I'm taking great joy in the fact that I'm allowed to play music more often now that Anne's not sitting where you're normally sitting. She normally tells me that I'm lucky to get one song in, and I always say, can we play more music? And she says, no, we've got too much to discuss. Except now I can just swing to a track.
So you're the boss.
I'm the boss, Anne. You listen to the show? I've taken control. I've turned into a megalomaniac. I've got all the power. No money, but all the power. Anyway, I've been away for a long time. I've been up in Taree and I've seen no music. And I'm starting my interlude back into music by seeing King Gizzard.
So presumptuous with tongue in cheek. So presumptuous, belittle me. So presumptuous, falling at your feet. So presumptuous, don't agree with your negativity. Eggshell in my stepping stones, kindred spirits at a crossroads. The world we build is on a tilt, bottled up inside and filled with guilt. Maybe you got a God complex, missing in action, didn't even notice. Sounds like negligence, featherless, shaken in defense. So presumptuous. Let go unwillingly.
state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress. The tower at 12 Holland Court, Flemington, has become a Homes Victoria work site, while the families still living in the building are being treated appallingly. Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents. Weekdays 7 to 9am and 4:30 to 6:30pm as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own. There's power in numbers, so see you out on Racecourse Road at the front of 12 Holland Court, Flemington, 7 to 9am or 4:30 to 6:30pm. Check Save Public Housing Instagram page for weekly updates. Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Yes, you're on Radio MMT with Kev and Katie today. Anne's taken a bit of a break over the summer break. She's been holding down the fort while I've been away. And now she reckons it's my turn to look after things, so I'm doing that, and I'm playing a little more music than we otherwise might have because I can. So that's nice. Now, Katie, we've been talking about, I don't know what we've been wandering a bit. We've been heading off in a few different directions, but we're basically talking about the confusion that some people have in understanding MMT. When you and I we sit here and we've been in the MMT racket for a bit now, and we kind of go, what's the big deal? It's just an analysis of the economy. But some people struggle with this. So what sort of struggles do they have?
Fundamentally, the struggle is that they're looking through the lens of the mythological...
orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they say things like, you know, what MMT is endorsing is something called money printing.
If you just print money, you're going to have hyperinflation, and you can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. And they talk about something called the money supply, which is also a deeply problematic term. As you say so often, because I'm an avid listener, as you know, money is spent into existence by the government and taxed out of existence by the government. John Harvey, an American MMT economist, says...
The cowboy economist?
The cowboy economist. Yeah. He does live in Texas, but he's very, very intelligent with it.
Yep.
He says money is like a haircut. You can't create it if nobody wants it. So, you know, you can't spend money in existence if nobody is willing to take it from you.
You're right, true. Okay, yeah.
So, like, the idea of money printing is nonsensical.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, people say, oh, the government can't just print money, the government can't just create money, otherwise you're going to have inflation. But the government does just create money. This is the problem with that argument, is that they say, oh, if the government just creates money willy-nilly, then you'd have hyperinflation. And I guess the important phrase there is willy-nilly. They don't create it willy-nilly. They spend, it's targeted spending. When I first heard the term money is spent into existence, I didn't quite understand what it meant. I sort of went, what do you mean spent into existence? That doesn't quite make sense. So let's just explain this in very simple terms. The government spends in the following process. It identifies a spending requirement and say, let's use the example of the military, because that's something which nearly all governments spend on, and it's a contentious subject, mm-hmm. as the previous announcer would definitely have said, but we know that they do it. And what's more, we know that the government rarely seems to have any trouble with how much money it spends on military, but it does it in the following process. It says that we're going to create a budget. It has its spending priorities. So the government says we're going to spend X amount of billions of dollars on the military this year, and it's passed through Parliament. They then inform Treasury, who then informs the RBA, who then starts sending out the checks to the soldiers and the suppliers and everything that's involved with the military. So there was no tax received in that procedure. There was no money borrowed. It was this and this is normal government procedure for everything, every time it spends.
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, because government has so many financial obligations that it can't be aware of beforehand and tax accordingly.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know from one moment to the next how many unemployed people there are, how many pensioners of various other kinds there are, what the demands on the health service will be.
A war might break out, a pandemic might occur, a weather event might occur. There are all sorts of things. And if we had to wait for the government to find money elsewhere in the economy, money which only it can create, because only Australian dollars can only be created by the Australian government. And even the ones that are overseas, that have been spent into existence and end up overseas, they were created by the Australian government. They can come back to our shores. You hear people like Barnaby Joyce saying, oh, we need the Chinese to pay for the coal, otherwise our economy would collapse.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of insane. It's
yeah, I mean... We don't need the Chinese to give us Australian dollars because we have an unlimited supply of them.
Yeah. What we need is the Chinese to want something that we've got, so that when they've got something that we want, we've got a fair trading system that we can trade with some sort of balance.
As Warren Mosler says, the founder of MMT, exports are the price of imports.
Yeah,
I mean, it is not good for us if we dig up rocks, put them on ships and give them to some other country. It does us no good. We get the environmental blowback from the digging them up in the first place. And if they happen to be coal or, say, natural gas or whatever, we get the secondary environmental blowback when they're burned. It's not good.
No.
We are better off leaving that stuff in the ground. But the thing is, we want imports.
Yeah.
And, you know.
That's what I guess affects the, when you're talking about how much is the Australian dollar worth overseas, it's worth how you can trade. It's the same as anything. If you've got a two-way trade, if you don't have some leverage, if you don't have something that they want, then they can ask whatever price they ask for something. If you need it, they can just put the price up. However, if you've got something to trade, then you can negotiate a fair trading basis. But all that money that was created, all the Australian dollars that are used in that trade, were created by the Australian government. Okay, and it's happened forever, but that's something that people can't get their heads around.
Yeah, yeah, and it gets very, very complex very quickly.
Yeah.
Like international finance is a real mind bender.
Yeah,
yeah. Essentially, at some point, Australian dollar denominated credit, in order for it to be acceptable, it has to be backed by Australian dollars sitting in an Australian bank account somewhere. So when we talk about, you know, financial capital flight and things like that, it actually doesn't exist. The Australian dollars can't leave the country. They have to be held by an institution that has an account at the Reserve Bank of Australia.
Right, okay.
So, you know, nothing ever leaves the country except ownership of bank accounts.
Yeah. I guess there's a simple way to understand the economy in this respect is that there's a currency issuer, which is the Australian government, and there's a currency user, which is everybody else, including overseas organisations, including overseas governments. Anybody who uses Australian dollars is a currency user, just like you and I. And that also applies to state governments, etc. So although the trade between all of these currency users can become quite complicated, they're all currency users, and they're all using dollars that were created by the Australian government, nobody else. And so when you hear somebody like Barnaby Joyce saying that we need China to pay for stuff, that's a misinterpretation of the relationship. And it sounds like China is creating the money that the Australian dollars that we need, when that's not what it's about. What it's about are the resources that are being traded, and if Australia needs China to buy stuff from us, it's because of the balance of trade stuff, and it's not because they're creating Australian dollars.
Yeah, it's because we want the stuff that they've made.
Yeah,
there's no other reason to do it.
Yeah. So how do we explain to people who say that if the government just creates dollars, it's going to cause inflation? How do we explain to them that Australian government does create the dollars, and sometimes there's inflation, but most of the time there's not? So I would have thought that just that argument in itself is that if the Australian government creates dollars, it's going to create inflation. And then you say, well, the Australian government does create dollars, and most of the time it doesn't create inflation. Shouldn't that just be an argument enough to solve that one?
Yeah. I mean, well, yes, the Australian federal government can only spend newly created dollars. The problem is that when people think of money as this naturally occurring substance that is like a physical commodity, they start thinking in terms of, oh, we can have too much of it, because they're looking at it as a supply and demand issue. They're looking at it in terms of simple, oh, we've all got loads of Australian dollars. We don't have so much, say, steel.
Right.
So if we increase the amount of Australian dollars further, then the price of steel will rise.
Right, okay.
But so, I mean,
that's a bit of a cognitive disconnect, isn't it? It's kind of like it's putting the money before the resource. This is, I guess, a fundamental problem with the way people regard money, is they, like you say, they think it has intrinsic value when it's basically just an account. Actually, this is the one about the post-COVID inflation. The argument.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you can look at the data on that. This model of how inflation works may be true under some circumstances, but it certainly hasn't been true for any bout of inflation in the last 50 years. And you can see that very clearly with the COVID inflation.
The logic from the people that say that if you increase the money supply, you're going to create inflation. What essentially they're saying is that when Scott Morrison spent hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy, what that meant was that when I went to the petrol station to put diesel in my van, which I'm hoping to convert to electricity over some time, but that's going to cost a bit of money. Mm. Another story. But when I went to the service station, their logic is that, Kev's got more money in his pocket, so rather than pay $1.50 a litre for diesel, he's just going to give him $2.50 a litre because he's got more money. That's their logic.
Yeah.
Or the other side of the logic might be that if the oil companies understand that there's more money in the economy, they'll push their prices up. But any organisation is only going to push their prices up for as much as they can get away with. They're all money-grubbing institutions.
Yeah.
What the neoclassical economists are saying is that Kev has got more money in his pocket, so he's just going to pay more for diesel because he's feeling generous. The real story is that the oil companies are going to price gouge, and because governments aren't regulating and because there's this whole international network of price setting, they're going to get away with it.
Mm.
That was what caused inflation.
Yeah.
Not the fact that Morrison had spent hundreds of billions into the economy, but that these organisations, the oil companies, the supermarkets, the supply companies, could get away with it.
Well, a further wrinkle is what we're talking about when we talk about money. If you open a bank account by giving a bank, you know, $500 in cash, they don't stick that cash in a drawer and then lend it out to people, which is one of the stories that people tend to believe. They just take it. And you've swapped government money for the bank's promise to give you government money at some point in the future. And complicating that further is the banks don't lend that out. They are not constrained in how much money they can lend, except insofar as, you know, regulatory constraints and so on.
Yeah, well, so and that's easily verifiable, because if you checked the amount of money that's been lent out and you check the amount of deposit that those banks have, there's a massive mismatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if your definition of money says that money is this naturally occurring substance that the government oughtn't at least create itself,
yeah,
then you have this problem with the fact that the amount of money in circulation at any one time sort of grows and shrinks with no sort of way of understanding how this works. So back in the 80s, there was this idea floating around called monetarism that said the key to controlling inflation is to control the amount of money in circulation, money being defined very, very broadly and in multiple different ways. It turned out that didn't work because it's based on all these flawed premises.
Right.
So by the 90s, we'd switched to this idea that we can't control the quantity of money in circulation, but we can control the price. by setting a base rate for interest. And that, they presume, it will control how much lending goes on, because you might suddenly be priced out of borrowing money because the banks need to make more money than they're being charged.
As you say that,
with that overnight rate,
that kind of makes sense at a very, very basic level, but it misses out on a whole bunch of other things, which just don't make sense with that statement. So if you make money more expensive to borrow, then yeah, people are going to be less inclined to borrow, and that's going to slow things down. But as we saw in COVID, and when you apply that theory that, okay, so we need to restrict the amount of money that people are able to spend, and you target only people with loans, and you see what happens to the money flow there. So we see somebody who's got a mortgage, say a young home buyer, and they haven't paid their house off. They have to pay more on their mortgage because the bank has put the interest rate up. The bank receives that money. That money then flows through the banking system, so that you end up with people who have savings in that with that bank. They get an increased interest payment. So people who have savings in banks are people who don't have loans, because if you've got a loan, you're paying your loan off first. So you see a transfer of money from people who have loans to to people who don't have loans.
Yep.
You see it also through their shares. People who don't have loans buy shares. They invest. Hmm. So you've got... And typically, people who don't have loans are older people who've paid off their house. So in a situation like that, you're seeing a transfer of wealth from young home buyers to older homeowners, property owners.
Yeah. What you actually get when you start mucking around with interest rates is you don't necessarily change the quantity of loans that are granted. You change the composition of the loans. You change what the loans are being taken out for. So if in a period of low interest rates, you have a great idea for a new business that you can afford by taking out a loan at the bank, but by the time you go to actually front up at the bank and say, well, here's my brilliant business idea, will you lend me some money? If the benchmark rate of interest has risen in the meantime, then you might find that what was a viable business beforehand is now no longer viable. So what does that do to the economy more broadly? Well, a lot of productive things suddenly become less attractive compared to just buying government bonds or, you know, say, investing in an enormous housing bubble.
Yeah, so it stifles innovation.
So you can eventually destroy the productive economy without knowing it by believing that interest rates is some sort of magical lever to control everything that goes on.
Yeah.
And we see that very, very spelled out in the contrasting examples of Japan and Australia over the COVID inflation period.
Yeah, because Japan didn't raise their interest rates, did
no,
they?
No. Japan, up until very, very recently, had the overnight interest rate at the Bank of Japan set at zero.
Right.
For decades.
For decades. That long. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, so they didn't raise their interest rates, but their inflation subsided at the same rate that ours did.
Yeah,
probably even quicker, maybe.
If you look at the graph, it's exactly the same story. The CPI was a bit lower in Japan to start off with, and it remained that much lower throughout. But in both Australia and Japan, the CPI went up, and then it went down again. The only difference is that in Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia raised interest rates and took credit for it when the CPI went down again.
Yeah.
But
I've mentioned
it behaved exactly the same in both Australia and Japan didn't futz about with interest rates at all.
I've used the analogy before. There was an episode of The Simpsons, and Lisa was trying to explain to Homer. It was saying, Dad, your logic is kind of like what you're saying is because there's a rock at the front of the house, there's no tigers in the neighbourhood. Mm. And of course, Homer goes, don't move that rock. You know, but it's that similar logic. Just because something is coincidental doesn't mean that the causality is there.
Yeah.
And so what we see with Japan and Australia is they didn't raise their interest rates. Inflation subsided because inflation was always a supply side, not a demand side issue. It was price gouging. It was blockages with transportation because of COVID. It was all these reasons that the prices went up. It wasn't because people had too much money in their pocket. It wasn't because Scott Morrison was propping up the economy. It was because there were genuine supply side problems and price gouging. And when they subsided, inflation subsided.
Yeah, the classic account of this was provided by an economist called Isabella Weber. And she wrote a Guardian article saying, look, what's happening is we're getting a supply shock from the consequences of COVID, ships not getting into port and not being able to unload and so on and so forth, which subsequently is used as a pretext for raising prices all the way along supply chains. Paul Krugman, then writing at the New York Times, bless him, wrote a column saying this is the most stupid thing he's ever heard. Which then drove her to actually go out and do the academic work, right. Actually talk to businesses and say, well, how do you set your prices? Yeah. It's got, it's nothing to do with supply and demand. It's a question of, it's very, very hard to be the person in your industry that raises prices first.
Because nobody's going to buy you. You put yourself at a disadvantage.
You're going to lose market share.
Yeah.
So when there's a pretext for everyone to raise prices simultaneously and everyone understands the rules of the game,
yep.
That's what they do. And they'll not only raise prices to cover the surge in costs to them, they'll raise it further.
Yeah. And that's where you need government regulation to come in. I mean, like a lot of the things which applied to COVID also applied to the situation in World War II, where you've got, I might be drawing a bit of a bow there, but what you had in World War II was enormous government spending, money flying everywhere, but inflation was kept under control by strong government regulation, including rationing and draining money via bonds to stop immediate spending, to postpone that spending to later on, which took the pressure off prices rising, etc. It's always more complicated than it seems, but it's always more simple than it seems at the same time, Katie. And that's kind of why I don't understand why people who are supposed to be experts at this and have positions of influence. So I'm talking about journalists. I'm talking about current economists. If you're a modern day economist and somebody presented you with a train of thought, a logic that was superior to the one that you've been using, even if you'd done the course, why wouldn't you? Wouldn't you say thank you and embrace it rather than push back?
The core principles of MMT are very simple. The problem arises is that the real world is complicated. And
unnecessarily so.
Politicians don't like to be told this. They like to. It's actually quite appealing for them to have a mainstream economist say, "Well, look, the solution to the to your problem is like if you have inflation that's too high, make this number go up. If you have inflation that's too low, make this number go down." And that's all you have to do. You don't have to do more than that.
And don't think about it too much. Hey, we've been talking for too long. We need to have another song. I'm going to swing to Adelita. Adelita with a song called Hot Air, for no other reason than I like it.
Can't wait.
I'm waiting still. Here we go.
This sound is soothing.
You're listening to Radio MMT. That was Adelita, who I'm fading out because we need to wrap up the show to let Mafalda in next. Thank you, Katie, for coming in today. It was a bit of a rambling show, I must admit.
It certainly was.
As you know, well, look, if you listened to this show before, Anne does all the preparatory work, and I just sort of I'm a bit looser, and so we were loose today. But we talked about inflation, we talked about COVID inflation, we talked about where money comes from, we talked about lots of things which people might find interesting, and hopefully, if you're listening and you're sort of wondering how the economy works, you might have latched onto something and might have made your Friday drive home from work a little more interesting. Or if you're listening to this on the podcast, you know. You're speaking to like-minded people. Thank you, Katie.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you for coming in, filling in.
Radio MMT.
The facts about economics.
Radio MMT.
With Anne and Kev, bringing you fair and balanced reporting.
They are bastards, utter and complete bastards, Anne.
That's right. We're really digging into this bastardry.
It's a smokescreen for corporations to increase their profit margin.
All these big lies.
Corporate profit and greed.
They're considering it in their evil plans.
He's the archetype megalomaniac neoliberal.
The government pretending to be there for the people.
The neoliberal ethos of squeezing workers.
This power struggle is continuously playing out under our very noses.
So it's simplistic and it's inaccurate.
What kind of an economic recovery strategy is that?
Do you reckon
that?
It's more effective to say it's spurious, to say the least, or it's bullshit?
Radio MMT.
The second and fourth Friday of each month.
Between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m.
Here on 3CR Community Radio.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.